Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Yes, political theater is good TV and sometimes relevant. Us, we've got economic reality today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, June the 8th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It's important to note here as we get going, both as a matter of civics and of news context, that the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. actually has two sides. The Senate side, whence all the high-profile action came today. We will take a pass. Thank you. But through the rotunda, all the way down on the other side, is the House of Representatives, where another big GOP platform item, the rollback of Dodd-Frank financial regulations, got done today. A bill called the Financial Choice Act passed the House this afternoon. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams starts us off with what's in it and what its chances are back on the other side of the building.
Let's get through the basics. Republicans have wanted to chuck some of the post-financial crisis regulations basically since they were passed. This bill, the Financial Choice Act, is a big part of that effort.
It's a comprehensive replacement for Dodd-Frank.
Justin Chardon is a fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center here in D.C. He says the Choice Act wouldn't undo all of the Obama-era financial reforms, but
it would take away a lot of the extra requirements, for instance, on large banks and on some smaller banks, too, that were instituted by Dodd-Frank.
It would also significantly reduce the power of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, one of several elements of the bill that have consumer advocates fuming. Diana Standert is executive vice president at the Center for Responsible Lending.
There are all types of provisions that are big giveaways to big banks and payday lenders and debt collectors.
However, this bill is unlikely to survive in its current form in the Senate.
There are some things in there where there is, you know, strong disagreement between the parties.
John Berlaw is with the Libertarian Competitive Enterprise Institute. He says some parts of this bill would never make it past the 60-vote threshold in the Senate.
There are other items in there, things with relief to community banks and small entrepreneurs and making it easier for smaller companies to go public, for entrepreneurs to crowdfund, that have already gotten widespread bipartisan support in similar bills.
Besides, he points out, a bill like this is kind of like a menu. The legislation gives the Senate an idea of what the House of Representatives can get behind, and then senators can pick and choose what will end up in their version of the bill. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Been thinking a bit about Europe today, what with the election over in the UK and all. We have done a lot of work the past couple of years about the continent's economic troubles, the Greek debt crisis, of course, shaky Italian banks and Spanish unemployment. Now, though, it is possible, just possible, that the European economy is on the mend. Today, the European Central Bank raised its growth forecast for the Eurozone, the countries that use the single currency, and it hinted that some of its stimulus measures, like low, oh-so-low interest rates, aren't going to be needed forever. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
It's been a tough few years in Europe. Greece, Portugal, and Ireland all had to borrow billions to repay their debts and prop up their troubled banks. Unemployment soared and growth was anemic. Doug Redeker is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
European growth has underperformed for a long time. I mean, I was going to say a decade. It's probably even longer than that.
The European Central Bank helped. Its stimulus policies brought interest rates close to nothing. It bought up government and corporate bonds, pumping $1.2 trillion to Eurozone economies to ease the pressure. Cash-strapped governments cut spending and entitlements. Today, growth is picking up. Unemployment in Spain, a dark spot, is down almost 10% from 4 years ago. Meg Lunsager is a public policy fellow at the Wilson Center.
It's all very positive, but there's still a lot of work left in Europe to do to make sure that over the longer term, these economies can grow and can converge.
Recent elections make that economic convergence more likely. Doug Redeker says last month's election in France that brought in pro-business and euro-friendly President Emmanuel Macron was key. He works well with Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, Europe's strongest economy.
France is huge. because France has traditionally played a role in Europe as the other part of the Franco-German axis at the core of Europe.
The European Central Bank today moved away from further interest rate cuts. It said it would keep buying bonds at a rate of some $60 billion a month, at least until the end of the year. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Traders saw the Comey testimony today and basically said, yeah, whatevs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Among the many other promises Donald Trump made as a candidate for office was that he would shrink the size of the federal government, specifically shrink the number of people working in it. What's unclear is whether voters knew he meant shrinking it from the top down. According to the Partnership for Public Service and the Washington Post, which track these things, there are about 1,200 presidentially appointed positions requiring Senate confirmation. 560 or so of those are key jobs, the very top levels of agencies and the executive branch. 120-ish have somebody in them confirmed and working or at least formally nominated, which means like 430 jobs have nobody, not even a nominee. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at why it has been so hard for the White House to bring down its own unemployment rate.
There are lots of reasons people go to work in the White House. Serve your country, be a witness to history, change the world. Whatever the reason, ending up here at U.S. District Court in Washington, testifying in front of a grand jury, not on the list. Yet scandals involving Presidents George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and Richard Nixon, among others, have all led to these courtrooms.
Monica Lewinsky testified before the grand jury today. She answered each question truthfully.
That was Lewinsky's spokeswoman, Judy Smith, in 1998. There's no indication that any of President Trump's aides or advisors will end up in court, but the prospect alone is enough to put a chill on hiring, says Max Steyer, head of the Partnership for Public Service, which works to make government more effective.
Anyone who is thinking about a senior post in government in an area that might touch Russia would be thinking about this, yes.
Steyer says the White House isn't short on resumes, but he says this administration isn't hearing from the best and brightest. And Steyer says that's partly because of the Russia controversy and because the White House also rules out anyone who said anything negative about the president. The Senate has been slow to confirm the nominees Trump has put forward, but, says Steyer,
that's only a relatively small part of the story. At least until now, there have not been very many nominations, and so unless people are nominated, it's difficult to put the blame on the Senate and their delays.
It can also be difficult to work in an administration that's under investigation.
So there is, I think, a nervousness. You do have to be careful, what you write down, what you email, what you say.
That's Joe Lockhart. He was President Clinton's press secretary during the Lewinsky scandal.
For my purposes, it taught me not to take notes. And just to rely on my memory, which thankfully was a whole lot better than it is now.
Lockhart never had to testify in the investigation, and he says 98% of the people in the Clinton White House had nothing to do with the Lewinsky scandal. Still, everybody had to be on guard, even junior staffers.
Not so much because you're doing anything wrong, but once you get into being talked to by the FBI or the Justice Department or a congressional hearing, you need someone to legally represent you.
And lawyering up is expensive. But the Trump administration's hiring problems go way beyond the White House. There are about 2 million federal workers at agencies and departments overseen by hundreds of undersecretaries and assistant secretaries. Most of those positions are still unfilled and require Senate confirmation. Grant Reher is a political science professor at Syracuse University. He says without those key people pushing the administration's agenda,
the government is going to have a tendency to kind of trundle along in the same direction that it was beforehand.
And Reher says add in all the other uncertainties and distractions, and career government workers might be
less likely to, want to work 80 hours a week because you're just not sure where the whole thing is going.
To be fair, staffing a new administration is always a challenge, and investigations are pretty routine. Watergate, Whitewater, Iran-Contra, but typically it's hiring first, then scandals. It can be much harder when it's the other way around. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A little bit lost in the Washington-centric news fire hose this week has been an important economic policy development out of Kansas. An experiment with income tax cuts, big tax cuts, in fact, ended there this week. Lawmakers rolled back a lot of the tax cuts the state passed 5 years ago, overriding Republican Governor Sam Brownback's veto to do it. The promise, as it is when tax cuts are on the table, was economic growth. Trickle-down or supply-side are the phrases you might recognize. But a majority of lawmakers decided that the budget deficits that came with those cuts were just too much. Stephen Caranda from Kansas Public Radio reports.
In 2012, Governor Brownback signed tax cuts that reduced income tax rates and eliminated income taxes for more than 300,000 business owners. He said the cuts would spur economic growth while allowing the state to fund core services.
We soon will have a new bold course in our state tax policy based on the people's ability to work, invent, and create.
But now, Kansas has been facing a 2-year budget deficit approaching $900 million. So even some conservatives who don't like tax increases said it was time for a change. Republican Representative Dan Hawkins voted to override the veto.
I look at this as bittersweet. I don't like the bill, hate the bill. But we have to move forward as a state.
Some conservatives pushed back, saying lawmakers should reduce the deficit with budget cuts instead of tax increases. But in the end, there were enough people who wanted to reverse the tax cuts, like Democratic Representative Jim Ward.
I think it's very exciting that Kansas is turning the page on the tax experiment. That's over. And we're back on the road to fiscal responsibility.
It's a blow to Brownback, who has continued to defend the tax cuts, pointing to an unemployment rate below 4%. He says raising taxes will hurt the state's economy.
I think it's wrong for the long-term view of the state of Kansas. I think it's wrong for growth.
University of Kansas political science professor Patrick Miller says Brownback made this conservative economic model his brand, his signature policy that other states could copy.
He put all of his eggs effectively in one basket, which is an unusual move for a governor, but also a very risky move that can either pay off quite handsomely or blow up in your face like it did for Sam Brownback.
Miller and others warn that this is not a complete fix for the state budget. There are likely more tax and budget tweaks ahead in the coming years. In Lawrence, Kansas, I'm Stephen Caranda for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, you know, we're in a serious model moment right now.
We are. It's true. What's trending in fashion? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added just 8 points today, pretty much flat, finished at 21,182. The NASDAQ gained 24 points, about 0.3%, 6,321. The S&P 500 up less than a point, 24.33 there. Traders, like a whole lot of people, I imagine, were no doubt glued to their televisions, but TV providers didn't get a whole lot of love. Comcast down 2.2% today. Charter down 2.4%. Exit polls over in the UK are predicting the possibility of a hung parliament. The pound is getting whacked after hours. Bond prices here, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.19%, and you are listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the winners in equities today on an otherwise so-so day was JWN, ticker symbol for Nordstrom Incorporated. Shares up better than 4% on news that some Nordstrom family members are considering taking the company private. Like all big department stores, Nordstrom is seeing a decline in mall traffic and competition from online retailers. And so, in the way these things work, the company, in fact, reported weaker than expected sales last month and warned of a sluggish year to come, which helps explain why going private is attractive. No more of those pesky quarterly announcements and analyst estimates to deal with. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Even as a publicly traded company, Nordstrom is a family affair. Brothers Blake, Eric, and Peter Nordstrom are co-presidents. Their cousin, Jamie Nordstrom, is president of stores. Here's what he had to say about emptier shopping malls in a call with analysts last month.
The trends around that have been
really consistent for the last year plus. There are less visits to the mall.
Some of those shoppers are buying on Nordstrom's website instead, but Kelly Hollinger with the Center for Retailing Studies at Texas A&M says most retailers are competing for the crumbs left by Amazon.
But these crumbs are still big crumbs.
If the Nordstrom family takes the company private, Hollinger says, they'll buy some time to assess their real estate portfolio, maybe invest in some new technology, away from the spotlight.
Shareholders always expect constant short-term positive numbers, and that's very difficult right now.
Privately held companies also avoid some regulations and accounting requirements. On the downside, buying out investors typically requires a lot of debt. Anand Sundaram at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business says consider J. Crew's leveraged buyout earlier this decade.
They had a lot of trouble meeting interest payments on the leverage that they had taken on and had to do major renegotiations with the lenders.
On the other hand, he says debt forces a certain level of discipline by managers. If they don't perform, they risk losing their jobs, or in the case of the Nordstrom family, their legacy. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, so as long as we're on retail, let's talk some more about malls. We have reported on the problems retail in this country is having and how a lot of mall developers and owners are feeling it where it hurts. A report from Credit Suisse not too long ago says that of the 1,200 shopping malls up and running in this country today, 25% of them are going to be gone inside 5 years. But that means 75% of them are still going to be around. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank takes us to a mall that at least today seems likely to be a survivor.
It's a warm Thursday afternoon at the Glendale Galleria northeast of Los Angeles, and the mall is packed.
We see more visitors than Disneyland.
That's Brent Gardner, the mall's general manager. An estimated 18 million people visited Disneyland last year. Gardner says the Galleria brought in 30 million. And he has some other numbers he wants to discuss with me when I meet him in front of a giant Target for a tour of the 40-year-old mall.
So it's three levels, and it was the first multi-level Target in a shopping center. And we actually take a lot of pride in the fact that we do have a lot of firsts.
First Apple Store, first Disney Store, first Panda Express. The Galleria is home to nearly 200 mostly mid-level stores and dozens of places to eat. And it's just across the street from another mall, the Americana. It's mostly high-end shops. The two malls form a sprawling retail stronghold. But how strong?
Well, what I can tell you right now is that we have only one vacancy in the center.
Gardner won't give me specifics on store sales or much else, but according to research firm Green Street Advisors, which tracks things like sales per square foot and vacancy rates, the Glendale Galleria is one of the country's top 100 shopping centers. One way it stayed on that list is by making big changes. A few years ago, mall owner General Growth Properties spent $57 million bringing in new stores and, Gardner says, moving existing stores around.
We ended up moving, I think, 42 stores. Like stores are by each other. Because, you know, business spurs business.
So stores like Skechers and Hollister, once separated for competitive reasons, are now next to each other, which makes things easier for shoppers. The mall also added a Bloomingdale's and surrounded it with luxury stores like Mitchell Gold, which sells high-end furniture. And those replicas of national monuments made out of Legos scattered around the mall, they're not just decoration. They're selfie spots geared towards landing the Galleria on Instagram.
We're getting ready to come into center court, and you can see the, you know, probably dozen people here taking pictures of, I believe it's the Capitol building.
Everybody's tried everything. The malls are in trouble. No question about it. They're trying to reconfigure as fast as they possibly can.
Retail consultant Harry Friedman says the shift towards shoppertainment is part of the solution. Retailers also need to rethink the whole idea of a store.
The smart guys are going to go to a much smaller footprint and absolutely have nothing on site. There'll be showrooms. Retail's going to shrink.
Paying a lot of rent to park a bunch of merchandise at the mall doesn't make sense when retailers can use a website and a warehouse. Anthony Dukes is a marketing professor at USC. He says customers are used to browsing in stores and then buying online.
What physical stores offer is a physical environment to actually inspect, maybe feel the clothing, test drive something, listen to the stereo speakers to see how they sound. That's something that online retailing can't do.
Duke says the last time he visited a mall was
when I had to walk through one to get to a restaurant. I can't even remember the last time I went to an enclosed mall for shopping.
When's the last time you bought something online or bought something on Amazon?
Yesterday.
At the Glendale Galleria, General Manager Brent Gardner says the mall isn't hurting for foot traffic. It's the other kind of traffic he's dealing with.
The trouble with going to the Galleria, it's parking.
So the Galleria is piloting a parking app. For once, a digital solution to a brick-and-mortar problem. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
The fashion aware among you will probably recognize this list of names: Gigi Hadid, Kendall Jenner, Anina Bing, Leah Kabide, also Alexa Chung. They are all models, fashion icons of a sort, who are now making the leap from showing clothes to making clothes. Alexa Chung is the latest. Her new line came out in May. Elizabeth Holmes wrote about it for Vogue. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hey, Kai.
So these women, Alexa Chung, Anina Bing that I just mentioned, why is it so interesting in the fashion world what they're doing?
Well, you know, we're in a serious model moment right now. Models are not just, you know, the clothes horses that they used to be. They are social media superstars, and they have a real power. You know, Alexa Chung launched her new clothing line to much fanfare. A lot of people know her and know her aesthetic. And so I think a lot of retailers and shoppers were super excited to be able to buy a piece of it.
Talk to me for a minute about this phrase you used a minute ago. We're in a model moment. The retail moment right now in this country anyway is a little tricky. It's fine globally, but retailers in this country are having a hard time.
Absolutely. And I would say, too, a lot of these girls are starting clothes or clothes lines that are in the luxury price point, mm-hmm. which is, you know, you're not asking someone to spend $25 on a T-shirt. You're asking them to spend $400 on a T-shirt.
Really? Seriously?
Some of these girls, it just sort of depends. And so with the mass audience, I think there's a little bit of a lower bar. When you're wanting to start in the luxury realm and get the attention of those retailers, I would say, you know, if they're going to ask shoppers to spend $1,000 on a leather jacket, it has to be a really good leather jacket.
Yeah,
it can't just have a model name on it.
Yeah. You mentioned this in your piece, Elizabeth Hurley, who did it back in the 2000s someplace. These women are sort of the next generation of that, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I would say, you know, look at somebody like Kendall Jenner or Gigi Hadid. These girls have a real branding power behind them. They have, you know, millions of followers and people get really excited. A lot of times what happens, though, is they don't try and start their own clothing line. They look to an established design house to do a collaboration. So in the case of Gigi Hadid, she's got a relationship with Tommy Hilfiger. Mm-hmm. And so Tommy has all that expertise and that institutional knowledge. And all Gigi has to do is say, this is what I think is really cool right now. You know, it's a much easier proposition, I would say, to do a collaboration with an established design house rather than strike out on your own.
You mentioned social media very quickly in passing, but it is not to be underestimated, is it?
Absolutely not. I mean, I think a model today, they come with a mandate that they have to build their own voice and their own personality on social media. Now they have to really bring something to the table. And the design world really benefits from that because I think the more sort of mass following, especially a high fashion brand can have, and, you know, people will save their pennies and try and participate in that brand.
Well, yeah, but I might follow Kendall Jenner on Instagram. I don't, by the way, just for the record, but I'm not going to pay $400 for a Kendall Jenner, you know, endorsed T-shirt, right?
Well, you might not, Guy, but I think there's a lot of women out there that would.
In the generic third person, but I guess there are.
I think that people want to feel closer to these girls. You know, there's something about Instagram that's super intimate, right? Mm-hmm. You feel like you're getting a peek into their real lives. It feels, I hate this word, but it feels really authentic, right? Even though a lot of these photos are super posed and, you know, carefully planned. Again, when they put out a picture and say, hey, this is my new jacket, you know, maybe you want to buy it. People say, maybe I do. You know, I mean, it's so much different than having, you know, watching a television commercial or even seeing an ad in a glossy magazine.
Yeah, totally true. Elizabeth Holmes, her piece on models turning designers is in Vogue. Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, Dateline Canberra, Australia. The economic gears down under just keep on a grinding. Government figures out yesterday, Australia time, show the Australian economy grew at a rate of 0.3% last quarter. Not great at all, but that's not the point. It was long enough to extend its consecutive no recession streak to 103 quarters, almost 26 years without a recession. Think about that. Ties them, by the by, with the Netherlands for the global record. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 8 points today, 21,182. The NASDAQ up 24 points. That is 0.3%, 6,321. S&P 500, hardly worth mentioning at all, up less than a single point. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troh are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, interim being the key phrase there, is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.